Hi, welcome back to New Comedy Radio, part two, still into Sabrina George interviewing Earl Oaken at this club in Soho on a Monday afternoon. So you started doing, you'd done one club or two clubs, and you thought, what happened then? You sort of thought, this is for me, or?
Conscious as that, gradually the gigs on the folk clubs were gradually drying up. As I said, it was a slow process. It's in the early 80s. There were less and less of them. I've actually got a list of my gigs that year, and you can see, you know, this. I then got two or three more, and then there was this new club called Jondler's, which I went into and did. They knew that I'd been around. Remember, when I did Comic Strip, they were all new. I mean, they'd only been performing for a year then. I'd been going for 15 years already. I was the pro. So, likewise, when I heard about Jondler's and I wanted to do that, I went in immediately with a full 20 minutes. I've never done an audition and done 5 minutes, done to a 10. What I did was, in folk clubs, you had to do a half hour at the end of the first hour and another half hour at the second. So I had a mixture of strange and funny stuff.
Saturday, the theory was okay.
Written with nothing in mind, because something struck me as funny, and now I wrote it. You know, it was never meant to be a comedy set, because there was no such thing. I just like to have variety in my set. So all I did was then take 20 minutes of comedy out of what was my folk set, and that became my comedy set. And that's what I did. And
So I've never seen you do anything other than comedy.
Have you not?
Songs, no.
No, what do you not? Come along on Thursday, you will.
I'm going to be in New York on Thursday, but otherwise I would.
When you come back.
So you still maintain the dual, like, the broad spectrum of music, but you are now doing a lot of comedy focus sets.
Well, there's more work in comedy, let's be frank about it. After I started doing Jondler's, which was really good in those days, there were all sorts. I remember now that acts, we had the two marks, which were an actor to juggle, and they wrote things. The guys who used to open for me were people like Malachi and Myers. What happened to Mark Myers? He disappeared off the scene. He was good too. People like that, Arthur Smith was a compere. He had some wonderful, surreal intros for me. I remember what he used to say. And now, welcome on stage, the last of the angry young men. I don't know what it meant, neither did the audience, but of course it made them think, why is he angry? What's he going to do? It's great.
So not angry.
Yes, you can see how angry I am. there were some great acts in those days. And unusual, quirky things. One of my favourites, do you remember Steve Murray?
No.
His act was torturing Peggy Betts. He now runs the Arts Academy. Doesn't form him. He's more a bit like Tommy Cooper, but he'd talk a bit like a fairground barker, and he'd say, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, the wall of death, the wall of death." You see, he had a very small teddy bear, spread eagle, pinned to a vertically mounted gramophone turntable while he threw darts at it. See? Then he had another one that was beheaded by a mini guillotine, and a third one that had to plunge into a pool of piranha fish. It was all very silly, and many of the women were against us and kept booing, and the men were cheering. It was complete chaos in the room. It's very funny. Who else was there? Kit Hollabaugh? Jeremy.
Who became Kit and the Widow?
No, Kit Hollabaugh.
Never heard of him.
Her. She's the wife of Jeremy.
Jeremy Hardy?
Yes.
All right.
Great radio series called The Hardys at Home. Did you ever hear that? She's also on the first Batman film. He's a bit, not quite the same thing, but her persona was a little bit like Ruby Wax, it's that exaggerated American sort of thing. Which was clever, very interesting. I don't know why she does the formal medal, what she's doing now. Lots of interesting acts, though. I think much more varied. Over the years, I thought it's all got very technical now. I hear comedians backstage have a three-line something on the pull-out something else, and I have no idea what they're talking about. But it all tends to be boils down to drinking, drugs.
It's probably funnier than their set. That's probably funnier than their set.
No, it's not. It's terribly intense. And it's all serious. See, when I go on tour with musicians, you spend most of your time off stage telling jokes to one another and laughing at them. If you risk telling any joke to a comedian off stage, there apparently is a law saying you mustn't laugh, because if you laugh, that somehow implies that the other guy is more funny than you are. It's all very strange power game. It's beyond me. I take no notice of it at all. So I've never been one who hangs out with comedians for that reason, because it becomes horribly serious and intense.
Lack of joy. Yes.
And my favourite comedy has always been silly. What I haven't told you so far, because you wouldn't know, the real background to my comedy is my father. During the war, because your father's always supposed to be older than you, but at the time he was in his 20s in the RAF, and his real job was teaching people how to mend planes, which is quite important at the time. But whenever he had a second off, he'd run all the shows. He was only a corporal, but he had wing commanders coming and going, "I'm corporal, we have to get tickets with the So it's all because all the people who weren't regulars in the forces, they didn't care what rank you are, but anyway, he directed plays, proper acting plays, so he'd been on. He was going to be on TV in 39 as an actor, and then this thing called World War II came along. A bit like my life, really. So he ran plays in the war, and he also ran a variety show and wrote comedy material for the people. And out of his show came two people who had a TV series later on. One was called Dick Emery, and the other one was called Harry Worth.
Oh, yeah. Huge.
And Harry Worth was originally, I met him, his name was Harry Illingworth, and he was originally ventriloquist.
Right.
He used to have two dolls, one large and one tiny. And it was used to end it out by singing, "Grab your hat and get your hat." And then the doll, the big doll, would go, "Make a warrior, I'm not dog pet." And he'd go, "Life could be so sweet." And then the little doll would go, and then he and the first doll would just turn around and stare at it. As if they didn't know what he was doing. It's very funny. And I remember watching the Royal Variety Show in the late 50s, watching Harry Worth on it, and my dad just said casually, "Oh, see, he's still using my material then." So,
here we are.
This is what I wanted.
Nice cup of coffee.
Breakfast time at home was having a pun competition with my father. Thank you very much. The cornier, the better. Thank you. Oh, is this hot milk?
It is.
No, I want cold milk.
You want a cold milk? Absolutely.
we start off, tree was mentioned, it was twigs, and I didn't twig that one, and well, I'm rooting for you, and I'll leaf it out, and it would be like this for, 20 minutes, So that's how it all started.
Was your mother going mad, or did she join in as well?
She was used to it by then.
Yeah.
She'd been married to him for a long time.
Because
so.
I would say that would drive me nuts after a while. Kids would love it, but yeah.
He was a very funny man when he wanted to be my daddy.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of the time. But he'd suddenly come out with a killer line just, when my mother was driving him mad, I remember one day. So this all happened in Yiddish, which made it funnier, but you know the word tuchus, don't you?
Yes.
Thank you.
For those who don't know, it's sort of the tail...
The bottom.
The tail end of a person.
Yes, tail end of a person. he was going shopping for my mum doing something, and every 2 seconds he'd got one step further down the stairs, and she'd think of something else. And he goes, oh, and don't forget that. And don't forget that. And finally, he just turned around and said, Helma, my mum said, why don't you just stick a broom up my door and start sweeping the stairs when I'm going downstairs as well? Upon which he just sort of collapsed with laughter, and that was the end of the conversation. But I mean, that's the sort of parents I have.
And that you feel was a big influence on.
Yeah, it had to be.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd been a producer of variety shows, you know. End of story. I wanted to, I mean, you know, you always compete with your dad, you always want to live up to what your dad did. The only thing I was ever able to do better than my dad is straight music. Because, and I get that from my mum's side of the family, because there were uncles who were concert singers. In fact, one of them introduced me to opera when I was 5, which is how it started. That's why I've got 10,078 now. I mean, when I say competing, not in a nasty way, but I wanted to live up, and I wanted him to be proud of me and all that sort of stuff, you know. So when people say, who are your big influence in comedy, I go, my dad. And then I was taken to my favourite film when I was 7 years old, and see if you can guess, some people get it straight away, my favourite film star, British. Probably the most famous film star there's ever been in the history of cinema.
Female or male?
Male.
God, I can't think. British.
I mean, super. More famous than the Beatles.
Non-singing.
Definitely non-singing.
Not someone like Cary Grant or someone like that.
Far more famous than Cary Grant.
More famous than Cary Grant?
Twice as famous as Cary Grant.
British. I don't know. Are they really? I can't think.
Comedy we're talking, aren't we?
Peter Sellers?
3 times as famous as Peter Sellers.
Bob Hope?
It's so obvious and you'll go, oh, of course. Unless you didn't realise he was British.
Groucho Marx, he wasn't British.
He definitely wasn't.
I don't know.
His name was Charles Spencer Chaplin.
Charles Chaplin, oh right, of course.
Is there anybody more famous than Charles? Even now, I don't think so. I think you can go into China or Africa, they've all heard of China.
Yeah.
I was taken as my 7 foot, I used to see shorts of him, what used to be called cartoon theatres, quite near here in Tottenham Court Road there was one. I saw The Immigrant and other shorts and I loved it. So it was my treat when I was 7 years old, I was taken, it was a very posh place in those days called Lion's Corner House.
Which I've heard about, yes. About the only tea shop ever in Britain,
big,
ever for years.
Big. It wasn't a little shop, it was massive.
But that's what it was known for, it's tea rather than anything else, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, yeah. That and jazz musicians late at night mixing with prostitutes during the war. But
I didn't know that.
Before my time. Yeah, because it was open at night during the war.
I thought it was supposed to be terribly respectable.
It was later on.
All right, but it started off a bit naughty.
Well, I mean, that time, during the war. But anyway, it was very posh. But before, around the corner, they were showing Modern Times with Chaplin. And, of course, the rest of the day, I was wandering around imitating him. And I remember, apparently, all the people were looking at me doing this particular movement that he did in one scene. And my mum heard people say, oh, I think we know where he's just been, you know, it's obvious. And to this day, that's one of my two favourite films of all time.
So your parents never tried to dampen down in your showing offness? They quite
no, my dad
absorbed
it. They were hoping that I would, like my father, have it as an enjoyable hobby because they knew how precarious it can be. And that's why they wanted me to, you know, get the education, get the A-levels and get the degree. And I sort of went along with it, but since I was 3, remember, all I ever wanted to do was sing on stage. And it took me to the end of my 20s until I finally was able to give up my day job, which by then was deputy headmaster of a primary school. And every year I hated it more and more and more, and it was quite difficult. I've never been a great getter-upper in the morning anyway, but when I knew I had to go to a job which I hated, it became worse every year. And then I got a call to do the Wings tour. That was because it was during term time, I couldn't do the bars, and I had to say why. It's funny, about a year later, I'd done a thing at Ronnie Scott's, and I'd got to know Cleo Lane. And we were talking, and she said, you've got to be hungry, you've got to jump off the cliff and be hungry. And so I sort of did.
I was told that once by someone who had a trust fund. comedy, Hunger drives comedy, and I was just like,
well, it wasn't because it drove comedy, but because if you've got to do it, you've got to take chances. It's no, you can't do it and get the odd gig. You've got to do it, commit to it, and then worry about when the next, and say, this is what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
Not do it, play it, yeah. You've got to do it for real. And she was right.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
I should have done it 10 years earlier because, as you know, they're always looking for 20-year-olds. 30-year-olds are already over the hill. The people who run the industry, be it acting, comedy, music, whatever, they're always after the young audience, and they've got this, there's something they believe in, like the gospel, which is wrong, but they believe it. And that is this, that they think that 19-year-olds will only watch 19-year-olds. Untrue. Last November, that's 2006, had a very strange week. It involved doing a private performance for a bunch of Swedes in Darkest Wiltshire, two of whom were the King of Sweden and a lady called Annifrid, who used to be in a band called ABBA.
Oh yeah.
And then 3 days later, there was a rock group with whom I performed in a strange summer festival called Secret Garden Party, very badly named, it's a terribly kept secret. 20,000 people turned up. Anyway, this rock band had been on stage with me, and they became fans of mine, and they had a sort of minor hit and doing their first tour, their first London gig at the Astoria. Would I be their special guest? So I said, fine. And I literally hadn't, since 2006, I hadn't done a rock gig since 1979 with Wings. So from the King of Sweden, 3 days later, I'm playing 2,000 screaming 19-year-olds who have, there's no seats there either. And it went fine. 2 years before, I was the presenter of MTV 2. And ended up doing nothing that year except 18th birthday party. So, and being greeted like a long lost god or something. Most peculiar, but it's got nothing to do with how old you are. It's something to do with the sort of persona you present. Some people, I mean, say Rolf Harris, for example, lots of young people will watch Rolf Harris, no trouble at all. And somebody else who's maybe 20 years younger than him, they regard as an old fogey. So it's just to do with your particular talent, your particular persona, but the media, which has got more and more fixated on what you look like in a bikini.
I'm sure you look gorgeous.
I do, but I don't like to burst. But they want you to be 19 and 20, and that's, they don't care how you sing, which can be proved by listening to some of the recent hits. We won't mention any names. That's what you're up against, and the more the years go by, the more you're... So I'm hoping... It used to be that comedians were not regarded as being any good until they'd been doing it for 20 years. In the 50s and 60s, you didn't get any comedians that were under 40 because they're regarded as being, you know, boy apprentices.
Untutored, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You had to do your time, go around all the B theatres and work your way up the bill. But now, all of a sudden, if you're over 25, you're not funny. But there you are. That's what happens to it.
Let's end that section on that. So that's end of part two. I'll come back in a minute.